Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling this question that's been kind of swirling around, campuses and boardrooms for years now. Can a university truly be green if it's investing in, the climate crisis? So we're diving deep into the fossil fuel divestment movement at the University of Toronto specifically to kind of get to the bottom of this.
It's such a fascinating case study because we have these two really incredible PhD theses.
Oh, cool.
Each one was written by, someone who was actually part of the U of T divestment campaign.
Oh, wow.
It's like getting these two sides of the same coin, you know?
Okay, so give me the rundown. Who wrote them and what makes them so unique for our deep dive today?
Okay, so the first one's by Joe Curnow,
Okay.
published back in 2017. And he wasn't just like researching the movement, from afar. He was really in it, participating in all the meetings, the protests, experiencing that whole emotional roller coaster right alongside all the other activists.
Wow, so he was really embedded in the movement.
That participant observer perspective is really powerful, you know?
So he's got those firsthand boots on the ground views. What
Exactly.
about the second thesis then?
Okay, so that one's by Milan Ilnikid, and it's from 2023.
Okay.
He took a bit of a wider lens, I'd say, interviewing organizers from all different kinds of Canadian divestment campaigns, not just the one at U of T.
Gotcha.
But here's the thing. Both Curnow and Ilnikid found this like core tension in the movement, almost like two different ways of understanding what divestment is really all about, you know?
Ooh, I love a good tension. Lay it on me. What are these two perspectives?
Okay, so you had some activists that were like all about the cold, hard numbers,
Okay.
carbon emissions, let's call them the CO2E folks for short.
Usually a 2E, got it.
They were focused on like hitting the industry right where it hurts the wallet to speed
Right.
up that shift to renewable energy, you know?
Makes sense. Star of the beast, as they say.
Exactly.
I'm looking at some early materials here from 350.org, and yeah, they were laser focused on that number, 350 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere.
Yeah, very numbers driven. But then you have the climate justice contingent, the CJ folks.
Okay, CJ.
They broadened the scope like a lot. They were arguing that climate change is totally inseparable from social injustices, colonialism, racism, all of it.
Right, because the communities that contribute the least to the problem often end up suffering the worst consequences.
Exactly. So for them, divestment was about dismantling the power structures behind these inequalities.
Wow, so it becomes this much more radical act,
It does, yeah.
challenging the whole system, not just shifting investments around. So we've
Exactly.
got data-driven pragmatists versus systemic change makers.
Yeah, and you can see how those two approaches might clash a bit.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Did Curnow actually see that play out at U of T?
Oh, big time.
Really?
He even uses these kind of loaded terms, calling some members radicals and others reasonables.
Whoa, okay, hold on. Radicals and reasonables. Who gets to decide those labels? I'm already getting a sense of how tricky those dynamics must have been.
And it gets even more complicated because these weren't just philosophical differences, right?
Right. They spilled over into real strategic debates.
Oh, like what?
Well, just think about tactics, for example.
Okay.
Some activists were all about direct action, like confronting the administration head-on, protests, sit-ins, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
But
but
others wanted to work within the system more, like try to persuade decision-makers.
so you've got your street fighters and your diplomats.
Right. And each one thinks their way is the best way.
Of course.
And then there was this whole debate about linking divestment to other movements.
Oh, interesting. Like what?
Like the Palestine Solidarity Movement, for example. Some folks saw it as a natural alliance, but others worried it would like dilute the focus.
So already it's this tangled web of dilemmas.
Yeah.
Were there any attempts to find some kind of middle ground to bridge these perspectives?
Curnow talks about a lot of debate and struggle, but what's striking is how those tensions really reflect the power dynamics the movement itself was trying to like dismantle.
Oh, wow, that's deep. He gives specific examples of how these racialized and gendered patterns were showing up in the meetings.
Like what?
Influencing who got heard, whose expertise was valued.
That's such a crucial point, though, right?
It is.
Even within a movement fighting for justice, there are these ingrained power imbalances that need to be addressed.
Absolutely.
It adds another layer of complexity to the whole story, for sure.
It does.
This is giving me so much to think about.
Yeah.
What about Ilnikid's thesis? What did he have to say about how this tension between CO2E and CJ impacted the activists themselves?
Well, he found that campaigning for fossil fuel divestment, or CFFD as he calls it.
Okay, CFFD.
Definitely had a lasting impact, like a crash course in climate science and social justice.
Makes sense.
Exposing activists to both those perspectives, the CO2E and the CJ.
But it wasn't always a positive or unifying experience, right?
Well, not always. He found that many activists came away with like a much more jaded view of the university.
Oh, so instead of this bastion of progressive values, they started to see it as part of the problem.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They hit those institutional roadblocks and realized that, you know, appealing to the administration's sense of morality, what he calls the heroic choice narrative, wasn't always effective.
Yeah, that's a tough realization.
It is.
So disillusionment with the very institution they're part
of. That's heavy. Yeah.
And then there's the whole issue of the organizational structure, right? We talked about that a little bit before.
Right. Very informal, volunteer run, mostly. Yeah.
What kind of challenges did that create?
Well, imagine trying to run this complex campaign.
Yeah.
With constantly changing members, you know, limited resources, no clear, like, decision-making hierarchy.
Sounds like a recipe for burnout and frustration.
It was for some.
So the very structure of the movement was kind of working against itself.
In a way, yeah.
Yeah.
Ilnik Cicic talks about how this made it really difficult to maintain institutional memory, too.
How so?
Well, people graduate, move on, right? And all that hard-won knowledge and experience just disappears.
So how do you build a sustainable movement when you're constantly reinventing the wheel?
That's the million-dollar question.
It really is.
And it brings us back to that central tension, CO2E versus CJ. These two different ways of understanding divestment's purpose ultimately shaped how these campaigns operated, what they prioritized, and what kind of impact they had, both on the institutions and on the activists themselves.
Okay, now I'm really hooked. Mm-hmm. I need to know more about how these two approaches played out in practice. What specific tactics did they use? What kind of pushback did they face? And, you know, did they ultimately achieve their goals?
All great questions, and that's exactly what we'll be exploring in the next part of our deep dive.
I can't wait. Stay tuned, listeners. All right, so we left off talking about this tension between the CO2E and CJ framings of the fossil fuel divestment movement.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the CJ perspective, like, gained momentum over time. What did that actually look like in action, you know?
Right. So one of the really interesting shifts Ilnicki observed was this rise of enemy naming within these campaigns.
Enemy naming. Okay, that sounds a little intense. Break it down for me.
Yeah, no, it is, kind of.
Yeah.
But think of it as like a strategic evolution, right? Hmm. Early on, the focus was mostly on, like, you know, the environmental damage caused by fossil fuels.
Right.
But as that CJ framing took hold, activists started calling out the industry's, like, political influence, you know,
and
their efforts to actually obstruct climate action.
So instead of just saying fossil fuels are bad, they started saying these companies are actively making things worse.
Exactly. Yeah. It was about, like, naming names, putting faces to the forces driving the climate crisis, you know.
I get it.
And this tactic had some interesting consequences.
Yeah.
On the one hand, it really energized the movement,
okay. You
know, giving activists a clear target, that classic us versus them dynamic.
Right, right. It's super motivating to have a common enemy.
Yeah, exactly. But here's where it gets a little more complicated.
Okay.
While enemy naming was initially aimed at, you know, the fossil fuel industry.
Right.
It ended up, like, sometimes being directed at the universities themselves.
Wait, so the activists were calling out the very institutions they were a part of?
It might seem kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah.
But as these campaigns went on, they started to see those administrations as, like, complicit.
So they were seen as upholding the status quo, protecting their fossil fuel investments, even when presented with all these ethical arguments.
Exactly.
So they became part of the enemy, like obstacles to progress rather than allies.
It's a really interesting evolution of that initial tension, right?
Yeah, it's like the tension morphed into a different kind of tension.
Right.
Activists versus institutions.
Exactly.
And I can imagine that created some real strategic challenges.
Absolutely, yeah.
And those challenges were made even worse by the informal nature of the campaigns, right?
Surely.
We talked about how that lack of structure created issues with burnout, decision-making, all that mm-hmm. stuff. How did that actually play out, like, on the ground running these campaigns?
Right. Well, so imagine, right, you have this group of, you know, really passionate activists, mostly volunteers, all driven by this sense of urgency, but with super limited resources and experience, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going up against these massive institutions with deep pockets and entrenched power structures. It was a tough situation.
This is like a David and Goliath scenario almost.
Yeah, kind of.
And I bet that tension between CO2E and CJ played out in, you know, real ways when it came to choosing tactics.
Oh, totally. So the CO2E folks, they often favored this more pragmatic approach.
Okay.
Focusing on lobbying university administrators, presenting them with like all this financial data, highlighting the reputational risks.
So it's about working within the system, making a case based on logic and data. Right. Appealing to the university's self-interest.
Exactly. But for the CJ folks, that was, like, way too limited.
You know, they saw it as working within a system that's like, inherently unjust.
Right.
So they were more willing to push the boundary.
Some more disruptive tactics, like marches, sit-ins, maybe even occupying university buildings.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow.
And this created friction, of course.
I can only imagine.
The more confrontational folks were seen as, like, two radical, alienating potential allies.
And the folks who preferred a more diplomatic approach were probably seen as, like, too cautious or too willing to compromise.
It's that classic dilemma, right? How do you balance radical action with the desire to build broad support?
Yeah, a tough one for sure.
And in the case of fossil fuel divestment, this dilemma was even more complicated because a lot of these activists were also involved in, you know, other social justice campaigns.
So it wasn't just about divestment. It was about connecting the dots between different forms of injustice.
Exactly. Ilnickny's research shows how, for a lot of these activists, the divestment movement was like a gateway into broader activism. Oh, wow. So it opened their eyes to all these interconnected issues.
It did, yeah.
But didn't that create challenges too? I mean, trying to juggle all these different causes at once.
Oh, totally. One of the key challenges Ilnickny Jogues talks about is this risk of spreading yourself too thin.
Oh, I feel that.
You know, trying to be everything to everyone and ending up losing focus.
Right. Chase two rabbits, you'll catch neither.
Exactly.
So these campaigns had to be strategic.
They did, yeah.
About amplifying each other's voices without getting bogged down and trying to take on every issue at once.
Right, exactly. And this required a lot of communication, coordination, willingness to compromise.
Not always easy.
No, not at all. And there were definitely times when, you know, coalitions fractured or campaigns kind of lost their way.
It's a reminder that these movements are, like, messy, right?
They are, yeah.
They're made up of people with different ideas, different priorities.
Absolutely. It's the nature of social change.
Yeah.
Rarely neat and tidy.
Never is.
But, you know, even in the midst of all that messiness, there are also these incredible moments of, like, solidarity, shared purpose, and genuine progress.
Okay, I'm ready to hear about those moments of progress. What concrete changes did these campaigns actually achieve?
That's a great question, and it's something we'll dive into in the next part of our deep dive.
So we've talked about the tensions, the tactics, the challenges, you know, all of it. But did these campaigns actually, like, work? Did they really move the needle on climate action?
Yeah, that's the big question, right? And I think the answer is, as you might expect, kind of nuanced. If we're talking strictly about, you know, dollars and cents.
Yeah.
The impact of divestment on the fossil fuel industries, like, bottom line, it's debatable.
Okay, so maybe it wasn't this knockout punch.
Right.
But were there wins in other areas? Like, did they shift public opinion? Did they influence policy at all?
Oh, absolutely. Both Curnow and Ilnickny highlight these less tangible but, you know, arguably more significant victories.
Okay, like what?
Well, one of the biggest was just raising awareness about climate change, the role of the fossil fuel industry, you know?
So it's about shining a spotlight on the issue, getting people talking, thinking about where their money's going.
Exactly, yeah. These campaigns generated a ton of media coverage.
I bet.
Sparked debates on campuses and in the wider community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they forced universities to publicly defend their choices.
It's about creating that moral imperative.
Yeah.
Making it harder to just ignore the problem.
Right. And the shift in public discourse had, like, ripple effects, you know?
Yeah.
It influenced government policy, corporate behavior, even individual choices, I think.
So it's not just about those specific institutions divesting. It's about this broader cultural shift.
Yeah, yeah. Normalizing the idea that, like, investing in fossil fuels just isn't okay anymore.
That's huge.
It is. And that's a powerful legacy for these campaigns, for sure.
What else?
Another key victory was the empowerment of the activists themselves.
Right. We talked about the burnout, the disillusionment.
Yeah.
But it sounds like there were also these really positive personal transformations happening, too.
Oh, yeah, totally. Both Curnow and Ilniki J emphasize how these campaigns were like a training ground for this new generation of activists.
What do you mean?
Well, they learn how to organize, you know, build coalitions, communicate effectively, how to challenge those in power.
So even if they didn't win every battle, they gained these valuable skills.
Exactly. And a lot of them went on to become leaders in other social justice movements.
Wow. So they took those skills and that passion and applied them to other causes they cared about.
Yeah, exactly. Think about the ripple effect of that.
It's like planting seeds, right?
It is, yeah.
These campaigns planted these seeds of activism that just kept growing and spreading.
That's a great way to put it.
And those seeds were nurtured by, like, that sense of community that developed within the campaigns.
Totally. We talked about the challenges of, you know, the informal organizing.
Right, right.
But there's also this power in that grassroots, volunteer-driven energy.
Yeah, yeah, that scrappy spirit we were talking about before.
Yeah, exactly. Curnow, especially, he talks about the social and emotional learning that was happening in these groups.
So it wasn't just about learning about climate change. It was about learning about themselves, about working together, about collective action.
Totally. And those experiences had a profound impact on those involved. You know, their values, their worldview.
It's a reminder that these movements aren't just about, you know, winning or losing.
Yeah.
They're about the journeys people take along the way.
And those journeys can have consequences that go way beyond the individual.
What do you mean?
Well, they can, like, influence the course of history.
Wow.
Think about, you know, the civil rights movement, the women's suffrage movement, LGBTQ plus rights. They all started with small groups of people who were willing to, like, stand up and fight.
And they changed the world.
Exactly.
It gives you hope, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. The fossil fuel divestment movement, maybe it didn't single-handedly bring down the industry, but it's been a key part of that global shift toward a more sustainable future.
Hmm.
It's inspired people, pushed institutions to change, helped to make climate action like a mainstream concern.
That's amazing.
It is, yeah.
So what does all this mean for our listeners?
Yeah.
You know, the people tuning in thinking, okay, this is inspiring, but what can I do?
That's the most important question. And here's the good news. There are so many ways to get involved.
Okay.
Use your voice, your time, your resources.
But it can feel overwhelming, right? Like, where do you even start?
It's true. There's no shortage of worthy causes.
Right.
But I'd say start with what you're passionate about.
Find your fire.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The thing that, you know, makes you want to get out there and make a difference. Mm-hmm. And then find others who share that passion. Join a group. Volunteer, donate.
There's power in numbers.
Absolutely. And remember, it's not about being perfect, you know? It's about showing up, being willing to learn, and using your voice to amplify the voices of those who are most affected.
It's about taking action, however small it might seem, and trusting that it'll make a difference.
Exactly. And that's like the beauty of movements like this, right? They remind us that change is possible, that ordinary people can make an extraordinary difference.
So as you go about your day to day, think about the choices you're making, the institutions you're supporting, the ways you can use your influence to create that more sustainable and equitable future.
Because in the end, the future isn't something that just happens to us. It's something we create together.
That's a powerful note to end on. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the fossil fuel divestment movement.
It's been my pleasure.
Until next time, keep learning, keep questioning, keep pushing for a better world.